and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast, live from the 2023 Convivium Irenicum.
Just wrapped up.
Just finished up. I'm here, as you can hear, with Colin Redimer. Reese Laverty decided to stay in the backwaters of the empire, so he didn't make it to the United States for this, but we are joined by another friend, Daniel Doyle, from Living Water OPC in Ohio, right?
Mm-hmm. Long time listener, first time caller.
Yes. Okay.
Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so this is just our, you know, kind of annual wrap-up episode where we talk about what happened at Convivium. Right now, we're sitting on the back deck of Davenant House overlooking the Blue Ridge Mountains. We're all sitting in rocking chairs, so you may hear some stuff in the background, you know, like birds or whatever, but it's a pretty idyllic setting.
Yeah, this is like, we're a couple miles from one of the only rainforests in the contiguous United States.
Oh, really?
It's like here and out in Seattle.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Blue Wall Forest, which is about 2 miles that way.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's gorgeous. So, yeah. Colin, do you want to just kind of get us started, talk about, you know, give us an overview of what happened this year? And
yeah, absolutely.
So, take it from there.
This is our 10th annual Convivium. I think we took 1 year off because of the pandemic.
COVID years don't count.
COVID years don't count. That's right. Everyone, that just...
it never happened.
We forgot about it. Men in Black came and erased our memory of it. But the 10th annual Convivium, it was fantastic. We brought Eric Gregory from Princeton University. Mm-hmm. Down, and he's an Augustinian scholar, and the conversation was, I think the title was something like Christ and the Nations, a Protestant Theology of Statecraft.
Yep.
And so everybody was trying to talk about, you know, the questions that I think are kind of surrounding, you know, Christian nationalism is a conversation you're seeing a lot on the internet, but, you know, we're really trying to do more theoretical work. We're trying to think through, you know, what is a nation? What does Christianity have to say about it? How should Christians engage in politics? Is there a particular Christian political theory? I mean, I think that's like a really interesting question because there's a lot of people who historically have said, no, there's political theory. And then you're just kind of a Christian, you know, on the side, like as a side gig. So Eric gave a couple of great talks, a couple of his students actually from Princeton who are colleagues of yours.
Yep, that's right.
There's one on Schleiermacher that I thought was particularly fascinating.
Yeah.
Schleiermacher, as listeners who don't know, is famous for...
It's the father of modern liberal Protestantism. I mean, sort of a giant intellectually.
Right, right. And you know, he gets accused of sort of evacuating the faith down to just kind of a feeling or this, you know, inner response is really the point of religion. But this talk was actually not about that at all. That's, you know, almost all I knew about Schleiermacher before the talk.
Mm-hmm.
But Schleiermacher had this, like, really interesting political theory, which included things like, you know, a theory that what Germany needed, he was kind of a pan-Germanist, so what Germany needed was to be united, and to be united under a monarch, but not a king, which, you know, that's a fascinating theory in and of itself, and so the monarch is going to be sort of elective, and reign for some sort of set period of time, and then there'd be, you know, a responsive way of sort of norming what the monarch is going to be up to through democratic means. Really interesting theory.
I thought Enoch's talk... I mean, so Eric gave a great talk, and I want to talk more about that later. But Enoch, one of the things that he pointed out is that there were a couple of issues that Schleiermacher is really trying to deal with. So the Reformation, in many ways, is this response to the problem of the relationship between the church's power and, you know, state power or the power of the magistrates. And so, you know, in the Gregorian reforms... in the Middle Ages, basically the church says, no, we're going to be autonomous, we need to be free and rule ourselves. But what that wound up doing was making the Pope kind of an empire, an emperor, right? And the church became an empire. What Protestants do is they kind of just decide for the other side. They're like, no, actually, you know what, princes should be in control. And so the Protestant impulse is to sort of put the church under the control of the prince rather than arguing for church freedom. And Schleiermacher... kind of try to split the difference, right? He wants like a sort of new, he's at the beginning of modernity, he's seeing the formation of nation states and industrialization and so on, and he wants a church that's both
established. Well, and he's seeing that, but Germany is not a nation, right?
Germany's not a nation, exactly.
That's the sort of key problem
that
he's running into.
But he wants a church that's free from the control of the state, but is still established, right? And so I think that's, he's trying to imagine alternative ways of... being faithful to reformational principles while also trying to give the church some freedom from being under the thumb of the rulers. So I thought it was a very fascinating... He also has a good theory of the university, which, I mean, you're very interested in. And so forth. So
That was one that caught my eye, Daniel. Any, like, of the talks that you were here, that you saw, what stood out?
Yeah, the one that really stood out for me was kind of Alistair's broad biblical theology of kingship from, you know, from Genesis to Revelation, stopping, you know, throughout the way, especially in the Davidic kingship and how that comes to its highest and most glorious point in Solomon, and then the downfall, and then the continual spiral downfall through Kings and Chronicles, and eventually leading to our Lord and his ascension and his kingship. But specifically, how he then connected it with something, you know, many of us witnessed a month ago with the coronation of Charles III now, and what role that plays still in British society, and what that could be in terms of a representational principle for the kingship of Christ over the nation, even if it's you know, not adhered to by the vast majority of the populace. Mm-hmm. Yet there's still a witness to that kingship through these ceremonies that people don't realize that's the purpose of it, but it's still being shown to them in a sense.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, the thing that stood out for me about Alistair's talk is just this insistence that the whole point of having any king would, from the Christian perspective, would be to show everyone something about what it means for them to be a king, right? And so this goes to, you know, there were various Lewis quotes throughout, but the one that I don't think he mentioned, but it was in the back of my mind, is, you know, you're all, once a king and queen of Narnia, always a king and queen of Narnia, right? These kind of four kids or six kids, I don't know how many kids are they in the...
They, you don't know?
Wow, there's the four kids. No, Colin. There's the four kids in the first one.
There's Jill and Eustace that
but
come
But then
later.
They bring in Jill and Eustace later. That's
but not in the same book. The Kings and Queens of Narnia line happens in a book with four kids.
No, but it happens again. They repeat the line.
But not with four kids. With a different set of kids.
I know, but so as taken
let the record show that Colin doesn't know what he's talking about regarding C.S. Lewis.
It's not true.
I know C.S. Lewis.
So anyhow, I mean, we're all supposed to be sort of kings, right? And whatever we see going on in the coronation process slash in the scriptural accounts of kingship is actually supposed to teach us. It's like, weirdly, right, scripture is not pro-monarchy necessarily. Rather, when you see the monarch there, it's supposed to be sort of telling us something about our relationship to God and to the world as intermediate beings, right, between the divine and the created order. And the quote he did bring in from Lewis was about the coronation of Elizabeth.
Yeah,
and so it's this image that he paints of this heavy, great big heavy crown being placed upon this small, fragile girl's head.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, whoa, you know, that's kingship. That's kingship. Is that all of us are really in that position, that the glory of being called by Christ is this kind of heavy, weighty thing, and it's being put on this, like, you know, pathetic ass of a body, right? To put it in words that are closer to Luther's.
Yeah, yeah. No, I thought that was interesting. And then one of the things that was nice is that in the conversation after the talk, I mean, Eric Gregory made the point that, you know, because I think there's a certain reading. So Eric and Brad Littlejohn, the Davenant president, both studied for a time with Oliver O'Donovan. Mm-hmm, so Eric did a master's with O'Donovan, and Brad did his PhD with O'Donovan. But one of the things is that O'Donovan, you know, tries to critique the United States for is the fact that it's not a monarchy and it didn't have an established, you know, religion. But one of the points that Eric made that I thought was really interesting is that civic republicanism of the sort that the United States has always held not that there is no monarch, but that all citizens are raised to the status of monarch, that we all sort of participate in the rule of our nation. And so even republicanism can be an image for the sort of, you know, the sort of monarchy that all of us are called to by Christ by virtue of being created as God's image bearers to the creation, you know. And so I thought that was actually kind of a way that, you know, I'd never actually thought of civic republicanism that way. And so it was a way for me to kind of reconceive of our political system in a way that can still have these biblical and theological resonances, but without an actual monarch.
So if that was, like, you know, the one that really stood out to me, one that stood out to him, and we're going to get to Eric Gregory, so you can't pick Eric because that'll be our last one.
But
if it was something else, what do you, what stood out?
I thought Darren Yao is another friend of mine, a colleague of mine at Princeton, and he gave a paper about the just war tradition and nonviolence.
But and nonviolence like the 20th is century not pacifism, necessarily.
Well, so right? That's what his... I thought was really interesting. So Darren makes this interesting point that a lot of pacifists, what they really oppose is coercion.
Mm.
But nonviolence, if you look... So Darren's paper was really focused on Martin Luther King Jr. And so if you look at King, King is not opposed to coercion. And so weirdly... but he's opposed to violence. And so nonviolence theory actually winds up fitting better in a traditional just war paradigm than it does in a traditional pacifist paradigm.
Because pacifists don't want to coerce people, right? Part of the problem with violence is that it's coercive. And actually, you see this when you read Gandhi, who, you know...
There's an influence between Gandhi and King.
And Gandhi will say things like, you know, the real violence is nonviolence, which is like... kind of a strange, that's not a direct quote, but it's a paraphrase. He talks about how if you really want to sort of stick it to somebody, you sort of like don't react when they're trying to provoke you to react. Yeah. And then he's like, that's really going to get them. And that's what we really want to do. And so King, I think, is drawing on that similar tradition, which is what Yao was sort of pointing out.
Right. And so what Darren was thinking about is like whether the nonviolent tradition that, you know, exists in liberal kind of Democratic or Republican societies is a sort of maybe way of appropriating dimensions of like reformed resistance theory in a broader just war framework, but for our own time. Mm-hmm. It brought into conversation like very different worlds. And I really appreciated trying to think about, okay, this is what the reformers say about resistance theory. This is what King says about nonviolence. Is it possible that this sort of vision of nonviolence could be an updated appropriation of our own tradition in that respect? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Several times throughout the conference, someone mentioned, you know, we should be haunted by Hauerwas and the resident alien concept and all of that. And he makes this claim often throughout his writings that he's not a pacifist. He's not a pacifist. He is for nonviolence. So I wonder if there's even like another conversation partner there with that, you know, to bring his version of nonviolence in as another bulwark to that idea.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I confess that I haven't read as much Hauerwas as I probably should.
You sweet summer child, Anzi. You don't know.
Well, I missed the sort of like Hauerwasian ethics. I'm a little bit too young to have been in the academy when that was still like all the rage. So I sort of missed that.
Well, I mean that. So to pivot then and talk about Eric Gregory, I mean, you know, Brad opened the weekend and then sort of handed it off to Eric, and part of the opening was this sort of questioning of why are we sort of talking about nationalism now? Why is this sort of a resurgent? Obviously it's a resurgent political question. It's also a resurgent theoretical question, right? Mm-hmm. And those are different, but related phenomenon. And if you think about like, well, what was the sort of dominant theoretical position 10 years ago? And I think it's clearly Resident Aliens. Everybody was reading Resident Aliens and other Stanley Hauerwas pieces. And they're thinking through questions about, you know, how can the church... One of the main things you used to hear is the church needs to be the church so that the world can be the world.
Right.
And so we're going to have a church that's sort of separated, that's set apart, that's doing its own thing, so that as the world does what the world does, people in the world are going to look at the church and be like, wow.
Right.
You know, and this practically, like, what effect did it have? I think practically it had effects of sort of developing the new monasticism and these kind of Anabaptistic communes. You had the kind of Shane Claiborne Jesus for President movement. There's a great book that I had a friend who contributed to called Electing Not to Vote, which is a set of essays about sort of why Christians might maybe just not engage politically as a sort of prophetic act. Was ascendant, one of the things that Brad was pointing out is that, like, you know, the tendency is when there's a fire and we need a fire extinguisher, you know, people are sort of not aware of it necessarily. But when there's a flood, everybody's running around with a fire extinguisher going like, we got to put out the fire. It's an emergency.
Right.
And so, you know, we were probably in the heyday, interestingly, of a sort of neoliberal globalization, And simultaneously, you have these kind of Hauerwasian theories that are undermining what would be like a much more hard-nosed, Niebuhrian political Christian engagement in the public sphere. Now, you know, we're sort of we've pivoted a little bit, and what you have is people trying to think through, well, what is the nation? And so if I had to sort of summarize Eric's first talk, I thought it was really valuable because one question that he was raising really well for me is that you have to answer that question, you know, at least twice. And each time you answer it, so what is a nation, sort of theoretically, but also what is a nation when you see this word, right? The goy or the the ethne.
What is a nation in the abstract? What is a nation in the Bible?
Right.
And how do these two things,
And you know, so his strong emphasis for the biblical question is to say, well, the one thing we know for sure from the Bible is that there's at least one nation, and it's the Jews.
There's at least one nation that's not constructed.
Right.
It is called into being by God.
Yeah.
And it is by virtue of the covenant.
Right.
And so that, right.
And then theoretically, you know, I think the my major takeaway was that he was trying, he was saying, you know, the question of what is a nation theoretically always begs the question, or maybe not begs the question, but it opens up the question of as opposed to what? Mm-hmm. And so are you saying nation as opposed to globalization, nation as opposed to internationalism?
Yeah,
or so nation as opposed to the individual?
Yeah,
right?
So I think he contrasted, there's kind of cosmopolitanism, he was calling it in one hand, which is the sort of kind of discrete individuals in a borderless world, you know, ruled by like a one world order. A lot of, like some political theorists in the, you know, 20th century kind of wanted
this,
like,
right? Yeah, like Koyev.
Yeah, right. The sort of...
Or most Marxists.
Yeah, and the alternate on the other side, there's a kind of nationalism that doesn't think there should be any sort of mediating supranational institutions. So you just have your own thing and your own like group of people, and you make decisions for yourselves. You're totally sovereign, and you have to try to figure out how to interact with other nations. What Eric was defending, he called a kind of liberal internationalism. And I think what he meant by that is internationalism is an order that takes the nation seriously as a unit of political significance and basically vests most kind of power with the nation, but nevertheless recognizes that there are relationships that obtain between nations and that these are good and can be used for various kinds of cooperation.
Yeah, I tried to push him in the questioning to... In my, you know, you only have like very little time in these kind of.
Everyone Q&A. Wants to ask questions.
Yeah. But that if what we're really talking about is the Westphalian system, the term that they would have used was the law of nations. That there's a sort of national community, but then there's a community of national communities, and that those things, you know, have a way of interacting with one another, which, you know, is adjudicated by the combination, frankly, of diplomacy and warfare. That would be the. I think the traditional.
I think that was kind of his view, though, because he said that he was trying to appropriate.
I know
the Westphalian
he said he was
system.
Trying to appropriate Westphalian system, but I don't know that he knew what I was saying. So it sort of opened up as a disagreement,
well,
but it might have ended up being agreement.
I think
if we
it
had
was agreement,
time.
But I think his point was that the Westphalian system basically depends on a background commitment to Christianity. Now I don't know enough about the Westphalian system to adjudicate that claim, but that's
sure.
what Eric said. And he was saying, so what you do need to recognize are going to be some differences between what we're up to and what the Westphalian system was up to, because a lot of their diplomacy was built on friendship between Christian princes who are like, you're a Christian, I'm a Christian, let's like figure this
sometimes
out.
Sometimes more than
know?
Friendship, right? I mean, they're cousins or they
right,
they're married
blood
your sister.
Yeah. And so in an international order with the kind of scale that we have because of the technologies that we have, you're going to need different sorts of institutions.
But I don't know. I mean, my position when I was up there talking is that actually marriage is the key. And so maybe we really do. I mean, if we want to like fix the problems of the world, we've got to get like, you know, maybe Vladimir Putin's cousin should marry, you know,
Trump
a
should
Biden.
Get divorced again.
Yes, that's right. No, I'm anti-divorce, but, you know, I think Hunter Biden is single, and I'm sure Xi Jinping has a niece somewhere. We can fix this.
Yeah.
You know, we can put it all together.
E-harmony for world leaders.
That's right. That's an app idea, man. Yeah. I'm taking that back to Silicon Valley. I'm going to be a millionaire.
Yeah. So that was the first thing Eric did. Daniel, you were there for the second talk or the guided discussion that Eric gave. You want to just kind of tell us about what that was like?
Yeah. And the second one, he was more trying to engage with specific texts from history and specifically from Luther was where we kind of settled. There was some Augustine reading and some Calvin reading, but the majority of the
And Rawls.
And Rawls, too. Yes. Yeah. But the majority, I think, of the conversation revolved around the Luther reading.
Yeah.
Just his approach to looking at what it means for a Christian prince to exercise that role. Those are not areas that I'm as astute in. A lot of my reading is much earlier than that. So for me, it was really interesting to just see how things developed. And political theology, especially even at Reformation time, is not an area. So it was a lot of learning for me. I felt like I was just soaking it up like a sponge and really enjoyed it and opening my eyes to things I hadn't thought about, which is why I'm here.
And he was talking a lot about supererogation.
Yeah.
And, this is like a word that I know I've read, but I don't really think about ever. Mm-hmm. So somebody help me with what is supererogation?
Yeah, I mean, I think most broadly understood, supererogation is the idea that...
This is like one of those Reformation terms.
But it's become actually really popular in contemporary analytic moral philosophy. So I think most broadly construed, supererogation is just the idea that there are baseline moral obligations that everyone has, and then there are good things that you can do that go above and beyond that set of baseline moral obligations that are praiseworthy and good, but that you don't have to do. Right. So this morning, Brad comes up to me.
Yeah.
I'm not getting paid to be here. Just saying. Yeah, I'm here.
No, I understand.
I'm not getting paid.
Yeah.
Brad comes up
you're
to me
under
this
no
morning.
Obligation, is what you're saying.
Under no obligation. Brad comes up to me this morning and says, Ansi, can you help me strip the beds?
And you were like, heck no.
I said, Brad, I don't owe you that. No, but what did I say? I said, sure. The idea is that, or Eric gave the example of like doing the dishes. If you don't have to do the dish, maybe it's not your dish night at your house or whatever. If you divvy up the chores, but like you do it anyway. You're not obligated to, but you're still doing something that we recognize to be good and praiseworthy. And so then the question is, how do you understand that basic instinct? And I think where the Reformation has a very particular reason for denying supererogation, and I think it's an important reason we can talk about it. But I think the intuition that Eric was pushing at is, if you've got a Christian ruler, and you think that the Christian ruler is obligated to do certain things, but you also want to say that the Christian ruler can be better than he has to be without being obligated to be the best he can be, is that coherent? And so where push really came to shove is Eric gave the example of a just war.
Mm-hmm.
He said, like, look, let's say that there's a war breaking out and it meets all of the criteria for a just war, and your king is having to decide how he relates to that war, how your nation is going to relate to that war. If it's just, does he have to do it? Does he have to go to war? Or is there some sort of discretion where we can say there are better and worse options? There's baseline moral commitments that he has to fulfill, but there are better and worse options. And what kind of moral language can we have to talk about a king being better than he has to be, or not doing, not being obligated to do every good thing?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I took the thrust of the argument to be.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I mean, he drew some very interesting contemporary examples from, like, the secular community, right? So he was referring to Peter Singer, who, I guess, is a buddy of his, teaches at Princeton.
Yeah, they're colleagues.
He's a famous, I'm saying this in quotes, everyone, ethicist from...
I mean, he is an ethicist.
He is.
I'm not saying he's a good one,
right?
You know,
yeah. But he, he makes arguments that, like, dogs are children too, and we shouldn't. It's very, very like animal rights oriented. But
he also invented effective altruism. So if our listeners know what that is, so it's kind of a utilitarian theory of. Oh, we're going to talk about
there.
It. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you talked about the animals first. Well, no offense, I don't really care about dogs.
No. But I'm leading into it. So but he doesn't just sort of make these theories. I think Eric's point is he actually lives up by them.
Yeah,
so
right.
He's like, he's not just sort of making theories about how animals are actually humans. He's also not eating animals ever. And he's sort of starting all these charities. And then he invents this theory of effective altruism, which is that, you should really apply utilitarian thinking to how you could do good in the world. And so therefore, it's not good for you to just kind of like live a happy life quietly and give some money away if you have the capacity to go earn a ton of money. Because what you should be doing is earning a ton of money and then converting that into, like, the greatest possible good, right? And so this is effective altruism. And he's actually sort of doing that to some extent. Mm-hmm. And so this is a sort of an example, I guess, of a of super arrogation happening in a sort of secularized context.
Well, I think because Peter Singer denies super arrogation. I think that's because Peter Singer thinks that the best, the maximal good you can do, you are always obligated to do. And so Eric was saying, like, Singer thinks that he's reading the Bible, like, the way that Christians should read the Bible. He thinks he's reading the Bible the way Protestants have read the Bible. It's like the maximal good that you can do, you always have to do it. And any sort of, like, deviation from that is a moral failing.
Right. And, you know, one of the problems with this is if you have this special insight into the nature of the good and you have the maximal sense of what the good is and you have the capacity to go do it, you know, what you should, some effective altruist really should conquer the entire world and subject it to the true vision of the good that's perceptible only by their sort of galaxy brain take. And I mean, I know people in the Bay Area who are sort of in the effective altruist community who then sort of like get out of it because they realize that the logical endpoint of it is like, well, the effective altruists actually have to conquer the world. And like, that's what they need to do.
That's not what Peter Singer's saying.
No, no, no. Peter's not. But I think these people have, they've read him.
No,
they've thought it through and they think that
But you never know what's, water in the Bay Area, we know it's suspect, okay? I mean, you know, it's like, you can't hold him at all accountable for what the Bay Area does with this idea.
The last thing that, that Eric said that really stuck with me is he kept going back a couple of times, I think in both talks, to this quote from Augustine that, you know, when we're thinking about the political from Augustine's perspective, one of the core insights Augustine has is that you know, everybody knows Augustine talks about the ordo amoris, right? The concentric circles of love, that you have to sort of, you're doing an injustice if you're caring more about your friends than you are your spouse, because your spouse is sort of living with
closer
you all the time, right? Yeah,
right,
literally closer to you. But when he writes about this, and I don't know that I'd ever, I mean, I'm sure I've read the quote, but I've like never noticed it, because he says, you have to think about who you're thrown into life with, and then here's the quote, as by lot.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a temptation, I think, for Christians to think that they have to order their life so that they get just the right people, mm-hmm. just the right mix or something. And I actually, this is like very freeing in my mind that Augustine's like, no, no, no. It's just kind of like whoever you happen to be thrown into the mix with, like those are the people that you have this obligation to love, not some random person on the other side of the world that you're in, or in the distant past or distant future. Because you can imagine a version of Christianity which doesn't sort of account for this or take this in as a factor that really is crushed, like the effective altruist, by this sense that like, oh, I actually have to sort of do this high, loving, I have to do everything for everyone all at once, right? And Augustine's like, no, no, no. Just the first question is like, who were you thrown in with as by lot? Mm-hmm. Figure out how to love those people. And that's going to be the beginning point of your political activity. Is how do I create a good life, a good world, a good common space for these people? And, you know, in my mind, as you apply that to the political, think about contemporary America, you know, you could have an argument, you know, and everybody wants to have an argument about, like, should these people be here? Should those people be here? Do I like these people? Doesn't actually, from the Augustinian perspective, therefore, this is a kind of a moot point.
They're here.
You've got, these are the people you have to live with. And that goes for whether you want to talk about citizens or immigrants. It goes for whether you want to talk about the red-blue thing, you know, if the BLM or the Proud Boys. Like, that doesn't matter. You have to figure out how to live with these people and how to pursue the common good with them. I find that to be very compelling.
Yeah, I think there's actually some real practical application for that. The church I minister at, in our town, there's a large undocumented community of people who've come up to work at some of the factories in our mm-hmm, area, and mm-hmm. our church shares a building with a Hispanic congregation that is almost exclusively migrant workers.
Wow.
And you know, we've worked through individually what do we do in certain situations if they get in trouble with the law, things like that. But one thing that's been important for us is providentially they're here, they're in front of us. There's a community here of people that need to be loved and love Jesus in a very similar way to us. They're have their own version of Presbyterianism, and so we already have lots where we have that really close connection with them, and they're on our doorstep. So for the past 5 or 6 years, we've been doing our best to develop relationships with them and serve them. It's a transient community, so that makes a difference. So they keep we have a different lot that we're thrown into every couple of years. Yeah. But that's what I was pondering and thinking as he was talking about that. That really is a situation that our congregation is faced with now and probably will be for several years to come.
Yeah. And right. I thought one of the, just to also, I think one of the other things that I noticed this time reading Augustine is that the order of loves, I think people tend to think of it, there are a couple of misconceptions of it. One is that what Augustine is saying is that you should love the people you're close to more than the people elsewhere. That's actually not what he says. Mm. Augustine says that you should love all people equally. But when he defines what love actually is, it's not about affections, actually, in that passage. I don't know if you guys picked up on this. My friend Johnny pointed it out to me. Mm. It's not about affections. Augustine defines love in that text almost exclusively in terms of how you can help your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Augustine says you should love all people equally, he means you should do good to all people equally, but that's not possible. So mm-hmm. you got to do good to the people who are around you, because right. those are the people that God has placed you with. And so the order of loves is really about, it's not about like an abstract sense of who do I feel better about. It's actually about who is my neighbor. Mm-hmm. And who is my neighbor is, in theory, everyone, but because I'm a human, I'm finite, I'm bounded, it's the people that I'm around.
Right.
And so when Augustine gives his reading of the Good Samaritan, he says, who is my neighbor? Everyone in the world is my neighbor, which just means that everyone I am ever around, I have an obligation to do good to.
Yeah.
To love, yep. to help them if they need help, and to be willing to help them should they need help. That's right. what, And so I actually thought that was a really interesting, because, you know, when you hear the order of loves, you really do tend to think that it's about, like, subjective affections. That's actually not in this particular case what Augustine is addressing.
Yeah. No, that's good. The last thing I would say on it is that this was, like, my reflection walking away from Eric Gregory is connecting this stuff into vocation, right? Because take your church's response to having these undocumented folks are, you know, questionably documented. Who
knows? Maybe some illegal immigrants, maybe some.
Yeah. So you've got this community who's sort of thrown onto your doorstep. Obviously, you know, every Christian's going to have to love them. The way that looks is going to be different depending on two things. One, where, like, if you're actually directly in front of them, you have a sort of greater obligation to do more good to them because they're just running into them more often, right? That's what you're getting at. The second piece is, like, what is your job? Like, if you're the mayor of the town, right, you have a different relationship mm-hmm. to this situation than you are if you're just a bystander passing on the street. And so, you know, I think in America, we have a tendency to sort of, everyone has to sort of think of themselves as a magistrate all the time, right? That's my...
We're all politicians. Yeah. You know, we all enforce the law ourselves.
Right. You know, yeah. And I think that's incorrect, right? Because there's a particular vocation that the magistrate or whatever, the president, the mayor, you know, that is going to have, that's going to require a different sort of activity. And that's part of what we mean when we talk about statecraft, right? Statecraft is a particular role that the magistrate has to sort of figure out what is love? How do I adjudicate in these tricky situations, like a doctor who sees a patient and has to have a certain insight into them? I think that vocational question, which we tend as Protestants to think about individually, what's my vocation? You know, I do this. What's your vocation? Your pastor, your vocation. I don't know. You're like some shiftless graduate student.
I just take money from the university, man. That's all I do.
No shame in that.
No shame.
But then, you know, I actually think we can think of vocation like, you know, families have a certain character. You know, when I walk into a certain household and I know one of the members of the family, I tend to know something about the family. The family has a certain character. The family has a certain vocation, right? Because of where its house is, because of where it's located. It has to, and I think on this Augustinian basis, right, of the concentric circles or whatever, of this helping obligation, you're just going to be formed into a particular kind of thing. And I think we can expand that and think about national character in a similar way, in this more, maybe more Aristotelian way of sort of thinking about character. You know, Americans are a certain way. And so, if that's the case, then I think we can talk about sort of a national vocation, which is helpful because we have to answer questions like, who are we and what are we supposed to do about it? Who are we next to? How do we care for, if we're the United States, you know, I guess Canada and Mexico, right? That'd be like the first question that we would have to ask, as well as our own citizens, right? Which is sort of like the kids of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. In my mind, at least, that was the image that was sort of coalescing the whole week together. But Yeah, it was a great week. I mean, I'd love to just kind of pick your brain. You've been to two of these, right, Daniel?
Yeah, this is my second.
And so, like, you know, if there's a listener out there, you know, we've just done our little wrap-up thing. We've told you all what the Convivium was about in a sort of content-heavy way.
Right, we just told you about, like, five different talks or whatever.
But the Convivium is a lot more than just content. So, like, what was your impression when the first time you came? What's your impression this time? Imagine that there's people out there who are like, I've never been. I sort of listened to the podcast. You know, what is a Convivium? You know, why would you come back? You came once. You must have liked it.
Yeah.
Because you came back.
I did come back.
We did something right. That's right.
Yeah. No, I think I've heard Alistair say it several times. It's Theology Nerd Summer Camp, which is I think the best way to describe it. The talks are wonderful, the discussions afterwards, but the heart is the interactions, conversations, sitting around the fire, sitting around smoking a cigar or having a drink and just talking about and seeing how the conversations move and how you know, you'll be into a conversation and it'll start to lull and you hear something else that, oh, that's really interesting. And you kind of turn around and now you're in a different one for an hour. And it almost takes me a week or so to kind of go back and remember like, man, what all the things that I talk about and all the different and process them. Cause there's so much going on. And you want to be involved in as much as you can, but you also want to develop those friendships. And even some of the people that were here last year that got to talk again with, Nathan Johnson, he and I had a good time getting to know each other last year and spent a lot of time talking again this year. So just building those friendships, I thought that's the real heart of it.
Right.
And then the academic talks and the theology really, kind of is what is driving it. It's giving you the bricks to build the building.
Yeah, I mean, unlike some sort of major academic conference, somebody was saying this to me, you know, if you go to ETS or AAR or something, these are in big cities, people sort of, you go to your conference session, then you just kind of disappear, maybe you go to a restaurant, you know, we're out here in the Blue Ridge Mountains, people, I mean, this is as rural as I get, at least, I'm sure you could get more rural than this, but I wouldn't know how, and so, you know, you really are kind of stuck out in the woods for 3 days with these people and you're hearing these interesting talks and then you're also engaging in these conversations after the talk because there's nowhere to go. So
you just hang out, you eat, you know.
Yeah. You stay up until 2 a.m. and eat all the breakfast burritos at 1 a.m., which I think, no comment, but may or may not have happened last night.
Someone didn't get breakfast this morning because of what may or may not have happened last
night.
That's
right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. The magic really is in the, I mean, you need the talks because the talks kind of give you a framework for discussion, but the magic really is in the discussion, I think.
So yeah.
It's always been a good time. And I'm glad that like, you know, I think this is, what is this, our fourth year, Colin?
I think it's my fifth. So it's probably your fifth.
My fifth. Okay. But you know, every year there's a couple, you know, sometimes more than others, but there's new people. And then the new people start becoming regulars. And then there's more new people. And then they start becoming regulars. And so the kind of circle of friendship expands.
The concentric circles.
Concentric
of
circles
obligations
of
to help that we have, you know.
Yeah.
Well, what are you guys reading? Oof. I mean, I haven't been reading much because I've been here at the Convivium. But I guess, you know, I'm reading Augustine's The Teacher, actually.
Oh yeah, you were talking about
which
that.
which is a really great text. I was reading it on the way here, but I actually, more than that, I'm not going to talk about that. I'll talk about that next time we talk. I want to talk about Lana Del Rey.
Colin wanted to make a Lana Del Rey reference in his talk, and then he forgot to. So now he's going to talk about
Lana Del Rey. I'm
going to
do it here. Lana Del Rey, man. Because when you really think about this Convivium, it's really all about Lana Del Rey's song, The White Dress.
Okay.
And you got to go listen to it. It's a fantastic song. It's about a waitress who's 19 in Orlando.
Okay.
You know, and that reminds me a lot of Eric Gregory and his talk. That's right. And she says, it's about theosis. And we don't talk about theosis on this podcast, but I do talk about Lana Del Rey, and she talks about theosis.
Okay, all right.
Because she says that there's something about wearing this white dress and being a waitress at 19 in Orlando at the Men in the Music Business Conference.
Okay.
And it makes her feel like a god. It's a very sort of like Heideggerian meditation on what it is to be a young woman in America today. And I related to it, Anzi.
You did.
I did.
So let me get this right. So being a 19-year-old woman in a white dress, serving a bunch of men at a restaurant, makes you think both of yourself and Eric Gregory.
That's right. That is correct. That is what I'm listening to.
Well, unlike Colin, I don't think that I'm a woman in a white dress. So I have been reading, I've been just kind of trying to do some background reading on, for my research. So I've been reading a little bit about, like, the development of as always, Arabic Christian theology.
Right.
So that's
you're going to be on this for a little while.
I'm going to be on this kick for a bit. I'm going to try to, like, read something, you know, something outside of that so that I have something else to talk about for the podcast. But for now, actually, I'm about to read, I'll say this. I'm about to read John Philoponus, or John the Grammarian. So he's a Greek father.
Yep.
So he's not Arabic.
He's
a Greek father, But his treatise against Aristotle's account of the eternity of the world.
It sounds terrible.
It becomes a really famous treatise, both for Christians and Muslims later, actually, in the Arabic tradition. Like, his arguments become very standard arguments against the eternity of the world.
That's interesting. Have you put that in conversation with Aquinas? Because Aquinas says you can't prove that the eternity of the world isn't real.
Yeah, he thinks that that's revelation, right?
The
creation. I have not. I will say that I don't think, at least, so I've been reading, like, Al-Kindi, who uses a lot of Philoponus' arguments. Philoponus doesn't argue that the world has to be created. He just argues that it can't be eternal. So, and I haven't read Thomas on this, to be honest. I just sort of know about his position. So,
Thomas' position is about sort of like, what is time and matter, right? I mean, so, those are the problems that he's running into.
John Philoponus, it's all about time.
Yeah.
It's all about time, and probably matter.
Yeah.
So, So I'll let you know.
Yeah, let me know.
What the argument is when we get there.
I'm excited. I picked up the volumes of the Peter Martyr Library, so I'm going to be jumping into those soon. So that's exciting. Great. But probably the thing I've been working on mostly recently is Stephen Charnock's book on Providence that came out in the last year or so.
I don't know anything about it.
So Stephen Charnock is the one who wrote the big Existence and Attributes of God, kind of one of the classic Doctrine of God post-Reformation texts. So Crossway came out with a new edition of those, and at the same time they published a smaller book that he did, more devotional on Providence, and really, really even putting me to shame as a pastor just how well he knew the scriptures, how well and how he could just weave almost any biblical text into an understanding of the Lord's providence and draw things out. And it's both a serious doctrinal treatise, but also a very soul-feeding work. So I've really been enjoying that.
Nice. That's awesome.
That's really fantastic. Well, so that's what we're reading for the spotlight today. I'm going to do, So we got some very exciting news, yesterday because we received the first shipment of the synopsis of A Pure Theology. So the Davenant Institute is publishing. So there's this 3-volume Brill edition that's, you know, Latin and English. It's very scholarly, and each volume costs like $150 or something obscene. And the Davenant Institute has worked with Brill and the English translators of that volume to get the English translation rights for a more accessible edition for pastors and students and people who want a kind of want an intro into this world but don't exactly need the Latin in front of them all the time.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say.
Well, that'd be me.
That'd be you.
Yeah.
That'd be me.
Right.
I mean, I don't, you know, I can mess around with a little Latin, but I don't, you know. But the point, the really big deal though, is that the cost for this 2-volume edition of the Leiden Synopsis is like, what is it, $75 total?
Yeah.
$85 total? Yeah. I mean, so, you know.
And if you're at a Davenant House function, if you come to one of these conviviums, you'll probably get it for significantly cheaper.
For like,
$55, I think, is what they were selling it for.
Is what they're selling it for here. So, but the first shipment of those has come in here. I think the people who pre-ordered those books will be on the way shortly. But if you haven't pre-ordered it, you were kind of waiting to see how it turned out. I can tell you, I haven't looked at them super closely, but the books look beautiful.
They're gorgeous.
It's the most affordable way of getting a good English translation of the Leiden Synopsis.
It might be our first time. I mean, it's a real step up for the Davenant Press. So I want to praise, you know, Mark Hamilton and the Davenant Press guys. You know,
they've done an excellent job.
We scaled up. You know, a lot of our books are sort of KDP, Amazon, publish on demand stuff. It's a really good model for a small organization for us.
But we're scaling. We're growing.
But we're growing significantly. And so we this was our first one where we ordered it in hardcover. And are like, you know, we're doing like, this is like a real publishing house. We are warehousing it and shipping it out as the sales come in. like normal people. So, you know, also, even if you don't want to buy one, you can just say a prayer for us, because that's a huge sort of like material investment in ourselves and in our thinking of what we do as a service to the church. I mean, we now literally have, it might even be Mark Hamilton's garage that's like filled with copies of the Latin Synopsis.
Right, until it goes to the warehouse.
Yeah, yeah. Until we get the warehouse opened, and then we'll keep it and ship it from there. So, anyhow, but it does look beautiful. I pre-ordered one. I'm excited to go home and read it, and learn a little bit about how to purify my theology.
That's right, because if there's one thing we know about Colin, it's been a consistent refrain of his throughout this weekend, is that he actually doesn't really know the Reformation.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, no.
He made it some offhanded comment.
Well, I'm not a Reformation scholar.
You've read the Reformers, but I mean, you haven't read, like, the
Orthodox. My point is, I'm not a scholar of it.
Yeah, right.
Like, I do Aristotle. I do Augustine. I could do Plato really well. If, you know, in a pinch, I could talk about Thomas. You know, and then I know C.S. Lewis really well. Like, yeah. I don't know.
It's not what you do.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people here. I mean, if you come to a Davin thing, you're going to run into a lot of people who, like, got a PhD in some guy you've never
every
heard
time,
of
yeah,
from
I
the
was
16th
gonna say,
century.
Every time I show up here, I'm like, I've worked for Davin for, like, 5 years now, and every time I show up, people talk about... there are more random Dutch dudes I've never heard of. Like, I thought, you know, years had exhausted.
James Wood gave a good talk. I wasn't at it, but I heard the synopsis of it. And
it was supposed to be great. Yeah.
and he gave a guy, this is like
Hodemaker.
Yeah,
Hodemaker.
This is like Kuiper's primary interlocutor. I've never heard of the guy.
Never heard of him.
I have no idea who this guy is. Yeah. But he's, you know, if you're a Kuiper bro out there and you don't know Hodemaker, you don't know.
I mean, how many of the Dutch are there? Like, that's the question I have. I mean, like, have we, like, discussed half of the historic reformational Dutch population by this point? But, yeah. So, anyway, go to the website. Check out the synopsis of A Pure Theology called, you know, shorthand Leiden Synopsis. It's a great work of sort of post-Reformation Orthodox kind of synthesis of the doctrine of the Reformed Orthodox. So, that's been the show. If you like what you heard today, go to Spotify, Apple, wherever you listen to podcasts. Give us a 5-star review. And if you don't like what you heard today, Colin, what should they do?
What's the name of your church again?
Living Water.
If you don't like what you heard today, you need to go listen to our friend, Reverend Daniel Doyle, preach at Living Water Church, Presbyterian Church.
But not the recording. I don't know if he records the sermons, but
if he does,
you can't listen to the recording.
You've got to go there. And
drive.
I don't know where it is, but it's far from where you are.
That's right.
I don't know.
It's in Springfield, Ohio.
Right, which Springfield. I don't even think is a real place, personally. Right. But I trust my friend here who tells me it is. You need to go there. You need to hear him preach, because you're clearly a sinner. And your heart is a forge for idols. And you're evil and desperately in need of justification by faith. And once you receive that and the remission of your sins, then you give us a 1-star review.
And that was Colin's best impression of the Puritans he's never read. So on that note, this is the Ad Fontes Podcast. We are the editors, and we will see you next time.